time?
Yes.
Did she tell you she was giving the child up for adoption?
Yes.
Did you sign anything, anything at all, taking responsibility for the pregnancy?
No.
No paternity test either, I assume.
No.
So you might not be the biological father.
I'm the father.
Reed, if there's no proof,
I'm the father. He scratches something onto the pad and mumbles,
"We'll revisit that one later. Do you know if your name is on the birth certificate as his father?"
No. Brooke says she left it as unknown. He shakes his head a bit, exasperated.
Then how does she now all of a sudden know it's yours?
She always knew. I hurt her. He flinches and I throw my hands up. Not physically. Jesus, Dad, don't you know me at all?
Sorry, he says, shaking his head. Hazard of the profession. Literal thinking. Carry on.
We had an argument that turned into a screaming match. I thought she was cheating, and she was so indignant that she let me think it. Instead of talking about it or even arguing more, I just started going out. Publicly, with lots of girls. I didn't call her, she didn't call me, until she found out she was pregnant. God, I don't even know what I said to her, but I made it clear that I didn't care. So she made her own decisions. I had nothing to do with them. I didn't know until a few weeks ago that he was mine.
A few weeks? Reed, why do you wait to tell me things?
He closes his eyes and huffs a breath.
And how do you know he's yours? Because she says so?
She's not lying. His placating lawyer face sliding into place, he says,
even if she's not lying per se, that doesn't mean she's right. She may wish it was yours.
He is mine. I pulled out my phone and pull up the photo. He takes my phone, unaware what I'm showing him. Glancing at the screen, he stops and blinks. Looks at me, and back at the display in his hand. His name is River, I say.
How old is he?
My father's voice catches and he clears his throat. 4 and a half, he scribbles on the pad.
We'll have to get a blood test.
He holds up a hand when I start to object. I'm an attorney, Reed. You're gonna have to trust me.
No legal entity or governmental agency is going to take the fact that he's the spitting image of you at his age as evidence of paternity. As well they shouldn't.
So we can't just sign the papers? Sitting back, he shakes his head.
Signing relinquishment papers does one thing. It takes away your parental rights to the child. It does not remove the state's right to hold you financially responsible and accountable. It's highly unlikely that they'll cross that line, but not unheard of. Especially if her bid to adopt fails. Now, where is he? I know people in L.A. County Family Court, of course.
He's in Texas. He was born there. My father does something I've seen him do only once before, during one of Mom's relapses. He puts his face in his hands and he says,
"Oh, God."
Chapter 15. Brooke. Production wants me on hand and looking hot to hype media interest at the Ziegfeld Theater opening of Hearts Over Manhattan, along with my co-star, Chandler Beckett. Tonight. To that end, I'm at LAX before dawn with a front row seat at the gate, facing a boarding agent who's clearly trying to place who I am. If box office predictions are correct, I may be less likely to encounter that expression soon. Critics are calling Hearts a heartwarming little romance, perfect for Valentine's weekend. I ignore the boarding agent and hunch over my laptop to keep what I'm doing private from my fellow travelers who are beginning to fill in behind me. I'm taking required parenting classes online. Having worked through 7 sections, I've got 23 to go. I plan to polish off at least 2 more on the long flight from Los Angeles to New York. The current unit concerns disciplining your child in public. While reading a section about not employing the use of public shaming for behavior motivation, I reflect that my mother clearly never took a parenting class. Chandler is bringing his tediously insecure girlfriend, Nan. At the premiere's after-party on Tuesday, I warned him to clip her claws or I was going to point her at the wardrobe girl, whom she has far better reason to hate, according to onset gossip, which is generally accurate. The guy has ample acting talent, but I should have demanded a bonus for every love scene. He's one of those guys who kisses like he's gasping for breath every second. No concentration, no finesse, no aim. How any girl, even Nan, would worry over losing that is beyond me. I'd be kicking it to the curb at the first opportunity. It slipped my mind to line up a plus one for tonight. Janelle said, "Don't you know anyone in New York? You can't just show up at your first opening night in a lead role alone." First, yeah, I do know someone in New York, but I can't exactly phone him up and ask him to be my escort. Thanks for reminding me. And second, why the hell not? I don't need an escort, by the way. I can walk from the car into the theater and probably even back again without being led by the elbow, thank you very much. That's not what I... Whatever, Janelle, let's just drop it. I'm going alone, and I'll hit the after-party for a bit, and then I'm coming home tomorrow. And next week, you and I have some things to discuss. There's an apprehensive pause. Oh? Like what? Next week. Fine. She's not genuinely angry, just exasperated. I've had that effect on her for a while. Especially 3 years ago, when our relationship took a not-so-subtle turn. She woke up to find me in the driver's seat of my career the day I turned 18 and fired the manager Mom had hired years earlier. The way Janelle accepted instead of power-tripped that day is why she's still my agent. We hang up, and I concentrate on the multiple-choice questions for the public discipline section I've just completed. Question number 4. Your child throws a screaming tantrum because you won't buy him a candy bar at the grocery store. Do you A. explain that a candy bar will ruin his dinner, B. plead with him to stop, C. swat him on the bottom, D. ignore him? I guess roll my eyes and wonder what the hell I was thinking would most closely resemble D. Click.
What you doing?
A voice says. And I snap the laptop closed, which probably means I'll have to start that section over. I turn and glare at Reed, who's relocated my shoulder bag from the adjacent seat and plopped down next to me. What the hell are you doing here? I whisper much too loudly.
Looks as though I'm joining you for opening night. Different movies, of course.
What? I shake my head, cobwebs clearing. You're going to New York. Today. On my flight. He smirks.
Or you're going to New York on my flight.
Pulling his boarding pass from his back pocket, he asks,
So what seat are you? We might as well get this over with.
I know for a fact that Reed prefers the aisle, while I insist on the window. And, of course, we're both flying first class, alone. I turn my ticket over next to his. You've got to be kidding me. 3A, 3B.
What are the chances that I'll make it to New York alive?
Reed has never, ever been a morning person. And yet he is alarmingly wide awake for someone who should be sleeping off a hangover with one or more idiot girls and missing his flight. If only. Better if you shut up and stay that way, I mumble. I want to get back to my end-of-section quiz while the material is fresh, but I don't particularly want to do it with him looking over my shoulder. And now the expectation that I can intimidate my roommate into muteness like I always do is shot to hell. I don't suppose you can just pretend you don't know me for the next 6, I glance at my phone display, or, oh my God, 7 hours? He smiles, picking at a fingernail. Without turning to look at me, he asks softly,
Why do you still hate me?
I falter before hissing, Like you're all good with me? Hands moving to grip the seat on either side of him, his shoulders taut and facing straight ahead. He angles his head just enough to look at me. His hair falls forward, hiding his focused expression from everyone but me.
I don't hate you, Brooke.
The gate agent announces the impending boarding process, and Reed breaks our staring standoff, turning to get my bag and his own from the seat next to him. I shove my laptop into the rolling bag, stand and pull the handle as he shoulders his only bag and hands mine over. Will our first-class passengers please begin boarding at this time? The agent intones robotically. And I march forward to present my boarding pass, Reed, right behind me. When we reach our seats, he automatically takes my bags and heaves them into the overhead bin, placing his in beside them as I take my seat. As he slides into the seat next to me, each of us pulls a drink menu from the seat pocket, avoiding eye contact with our fellow passengers as they trudge by sluggishly. It occurs to me that to these strangers we look, for all intents and purposes, as though we're traveling together. Half an hour later, we've each downed a coffee, and Reed has requested and eaten a bag of caramel popcorn. The plane taxis down the runway, finally, and judders into the air at a worrisome angle, but we haven't exchanged another word. An hour later, I clear my throat. Are you going to sign the paper? My question is barely audible over the droning of the plane engine. Leaning closer, but without turning to look at me, he says, I talked to Dad. We're requesting a confidential paternity test first. A blaze of resentment rips through me like a flash fire, and then I recall that Reed's father is, of course, an attorney. Like Norman Rogers, he's bound to proceed cautiously, more so in matters pertaining to his son. Proof is a required starting point. And I know better than anyone that the proof will be conclusive. Checking my resentment, I ask, how long will it take to get the results?
I don't think it will take long. I already did my part of it.
Oh? He shrugs.
It's not that complicated, I guess. Once they have his, it shouldn't be more than a day or two.
After another drink service, during which I order a club soda and Reed orders, and is given, a scotch on the rocks, he ventures,
I'm not sure what happens after that.
Everything is complicated by the fact that you went to Texas.
He lowers his voice to a whisper,
to have him. The relinquishment does no more than take my rights away.
You don't have any rights, I hiss.
Think of the title of this form, Brooke. If no rights existed, I wouldn't have anything to relinquish. Oh, God.
Reed. This after-party is the most over-the-top event I've ever attended. The hotel ballroom looks as though someone took a slice of Vancouver's Gaston District and airlifted it to New York. One wall boasts an animated projection of Burrard Inlet, while the remaining three walls are covered in convincing replicas of storefront facades. Bistro tables line the bricked streets, while globed street lamps cast spheres of light on squares of real grass and walk paths dotted with light-strung trees. In the center of it all is the Gaston steam clock, which, through the magic of CGI, is blown to smithereens in the next to final scene of mercy killing. I snap a few photos and text them to Dory. Me. Isn't this redonkulous? I wish you were here. Dory, I wish I was in L.A. Mom just called. Esther isn't doing well. Me. She's sick? Dory, I don't want to interrupt your night. I'm a mess. Maybe we could just talk tomorrow, please? Talk to me. I've found a private niche outside the ballroom. People are milling around in the hallway, and the band from inside the party is audible, but this is as discreet as it will get until I get back to my hotel and in my room. Dory is crying. No, she's bawling. The sound squeezes my heart like someone has reached inside my chest cavity and seized it, and all I know is I would do anything, anything to stop her anguish.
Reed.
Her voice is already hoarse. God knows how long she's been distressed over this while I viewed my stupid film and accepted accolades from the audience and the crowd waiting outside. The sound of her sobs turns me inside out.
I don't want to ruin your big night. Can we please talk tomorrow?
She's covering the phone so I won't hear the sobs between the sentences, as if I can't feel it anyway when she speaks. Baby, please talk to me. Nothing is more important to me right now. What happened? She wrestles with herself to stop crying, her breaths coming in slowing stutters.
I knew this was coming. Esther has lived a long, good life. She's my age, did you know that? When we adopted her, they knew her birth date, and it was the same as mine. The same exact date. Dogs don't live this long. I've been so lucky.
I'm about to snap this phone in two. I'm so frustrated that I can't comfort her. This long-distance thing is complete ass.
She started limping last week, and Dad took her to the vet. She's got...
More sobbing comes from her end, and I turn toward the wall, clenching my jaw.
She's got multiple tumors all over. The last few days she's been whimpering when she walks, and she stopped eating yesterday. They're taking her to the vet tomorrow morning.
She dissolves again, and I curse under my breath.
It's just... The last time I saw her was the last time I'll ever see her, and I didn't know it. I didn't get to say goodbye. Just like...
More tears. Just like Deb. Oh, fuck no. No goddamned way. Dory, I need to go. I'm gonna call you back in like 10 minutes, maybe 15, okay?
You don't have to call back. Reed, seriously, thank you for listening.
When I call, you answer, okay? Swear. She takes a deep breath and squeaks out a heartbreaking,
okay.
I fight the urge to punch the stone wall in front of me. Breaking my hand will solve nothing. When she answers, she's more hoarse than before, but not crying.
Hello.
Hey, baby. I've got some instructions for you. Do you have a pen? She sniffles.
Instructions? What?
There's a paper shuffling sound.
Okay.
Are you in your room?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Write this number down. It's important. 1360. That's your flight number. I want you to start packing. Now. A car will be waiting outside the Starbucks to take you to the airport. That flight leaves in just over an hour, and it's the last one of the day.
What? But you can't...
Do not argue with me. You don't have time. Pack a bag, get to the Starbucks, get in the car. The driver will drop you at the right gate. Go inside and head right to the first class counter to get your boarding pass. Don't forget to take your license, by the way. I learned the hard way a couple of years ago that they don't let you on the plane without ID. When you land, there will be another car. The driver will have your name on a placard, and he'll take you straight home. She starts crying again, and I'm afraid she's going to fight me, but thank God she just rasps,
thank you.
I bite back the I love you on my tongue. I won't ask for the return of those words from her, certainly not as a reward for this, and that's what saying it now would be. She'll say it when she's ready. Let me know when you get home. Don't worry about the time here. I won't go to sleep until I know you're there. Call your parents once you're in the car.
Okay. Thank you, Reed,
she says again. Go pack. I'll talk to you in a little while. If you have any problem, call me. My phone is in my front pocket and set to vibrate the crap out of my leg. Her gravelly little laugh destroys me. I return the phone to my pocket and take a deep breath. If Dad wasn't sure how serious I was about Dory before, he sure as hell knows now.
Chapter 16. Dory. When I was 6, Deb and I lost our last grandparent. My father's opinionated, quick-witted mother, who made the world's best sugar cookies, loved to sing, and fondly recalled her years as a piano teacher. At her funeral, my sister held my hand, and at the end of the day, she put me to bed. I love you, baby sister of mine, Deb said, tucking the covers to my chin. How much? I asked, Esther settling in next to me as she did every night. Leaning over me, her serious 14-year-old eyes shining, Deb whispered, as many grains of sand as there are on all the beaches in all the world. For how long? I pressed, and she rolled her eyes. Forever and forever and forever. When I smiled, she added, duh. We'd repeated this ritual on occasion over the years, though I'd never doubted my sister's love. Hearing her say it was a comfort that I sometimes craved. I've had to accept that Deb is forever changed. I'll never hear her quirky laugh or her sound advice again. I'll never feel her arms around me. She'll never tell me she will love me forever. She's gone, but not gone. And my heart is in limbo, unable to say goodbye. Because of Reed, I got to say goodbye to Esther. Last night, she slept next to me one last time, nestled against my chest, her intermittent whines so soft as to be apologetic, breaking my heart. We drove to the vet's office this morning, and I sat in the back seat, stroking her head where it rested on my leg, telling her in whispers how much I loved her and what a good friend she'd been. Her big dark eyes looked up at me, and I knew she was telling me goodbye, too. On the way home, I held her worn red collar tight in my hands, tears streaming down my face. I read the inscriptions on her tags, her license info, our matching birth date, her please return to number and address, and her name, Esther Cantrell. It may seem odd to think of a dog as having a last name, because they don't need it for school or a job. But it was right. Esther and I shared a surname because she was family, tip to tail. Kayla. Dory, have you seen the photos in the link I just sent you? Maybe nothing is going on, but I never liked that Brooke Cameron. She's probably as bitchy and stupid as her Life's a Beach character. Me. I'm sure it's nothing. I'm actually home. We put Esther to sleep this morning. I'm going back to Cal tomorrow. Kayla. Oh, no! Sad face. I loved Esther. I'm so sorry. Can me and Amy come over to cheer you up? Me. I don't think that's possible. But thank you. I'm going to visit Deb tonight. I'll see you guys next time, I promise. Kayla. Okay. Hug. We'll keep an eye on that Brooke bitch for you. The link Kayla sent goes to a gossip website. At the top are two photos, clearly cell phone taken, of Reed and Brooke Cameron, together. In one, they're sitting together at the gate, talking and waiting for a flight. In the other, they're sitting together on that flight. I spoke to him earlier today and he'd not mentioned her. Perhaps he's waiting for me to bring it up, or hoping I won't. He didn't tell me they were going to New York together, but they clearly did. There are separate photos of each of them there, too, attending the opening nights of their new films last night, both alone. No dates, no plus ones. The media, of course, speculates wildly over what that means, and the post includes a photo of the two of them from years ago, holding hands, happy. They look the age I was when I fell in love with Colin. I don't want to ask him about her. This day has drained me emotionally, and I'm incapable of thinking rationally. There's also my gratitude for the fact that, thanks to Reed, I'm at my kitchen table, making a gravestone out of a clay tile and ceramic buttons to place on Esther's spot in the backyard garden. 2 hours ago, Dad and I lowered her carefully into the deep hole he'd dug at dawn before we left. We positioned Esther's body as Mom stood by, holding a rawhide bone and her favorite toy, a squeaky banana, to be buried with her. Esther loved chasing and roughhousing. She was one of those dogs who discouraged any fragile things placed on low tables for fear of her long, constantly wagging tail accidentally sweeping them to the ground. But wrapped in a beach towel of mine, which she'd absconded with so many times, dragging it to her dog bed like a security blanket, that I finally gave it to her. She'd seemed so small. Would you like tea? Mom asks now, her voice as gruff as mine. Our grief over Esther has revived every anguished memory of Deb's accident. The three of us are wrestling with the tacit loss of my sister all over again, though no one says so. Yes, please, chai? Mom nods and moves to the sink with the tea kettle. She stares out the back window, gazing at that new mound of earth within the flower bed, where my identifying tile will go. In a month or so, the dirt will have compressed back into place, and the weather will be warmer, and Dad will plant new flowers there. Deb used to tell me hilarious stories of Esther as a puppy, how she regularly dug up part of Dad's flower garden to bury her treats and toys. She'd then deposit newly uprooted flowers on the back step, like a confession or a gift, infuriating our usually unflappable father.
How's Reed?
Mom asks, and her question takes me by surprise. He's good, I think. He came up for a visit last week.
Keeping my eyes on the tile I'm working on doesn't prevent my ears from growing hot, because I'm hoping she doesn't ask where he stayed the night. She's quiet for a few minutes, making the tea. When she sets a mug in front of me, she says,
"It was a nice thing he did, flying you home last night.
Are you planning on seeing him while you're here?" I note the slight judgment in her tone and answer defensively, "He's in New York, actually. He won't be home in L.A. until tomorrow, after I've gone back to Berkeley."
"Oh," she says, considering. She offers nothing more, padding from the room to take Dad his tea. He's in his study, working on tomorrow's sermon.
I can't imagine trying to stand up in front of a congregation tomorrow and be encouraging or instructive. But then, Dad had to continue doing his job after Deb's accident. In the face of it, even. No matter what grief or loss takes place, most of life flows on all around us, as though nothing's changed. At some point in our sorrow, we each make a choice to sink or swim. There's no other alternative.
Reed, the paternity test results are in. No surprise, I'm River's father. I anticipated this answer, of course. What I didn't expect was the irrational dread that tore through me. In the seconds before Dad gave me the 99% confirmed answer, I was afraid he was going to say he wasn't mine.
"He's definitely yours."
Dad's dismal tone makes it clear that this wasn't the outcome he was wishing for. I can't fault him. This can't be how he envisioned becoming a grandfather, assuming he'd ever envisioned that. Though legally, he's sort of not one. Yet. I expected this answer to amplify my frustration with the whole thing, foreseen or not. After all, the possibility that I'll have to tell Dory just became a probability. Legal concerns, something I thought I'd moved past 2 months ago when I got my license back, are about to complicate the hell out of my life. And most bizarre of all, I have a sudden, unwelcome sense of obligation toward Brooke. I should be ticked, but instead, I feel conflicted and relieved. What the hell? So then I think, maybe it's biological. If I'm a man, and I've reproduced. Maybe there's a sort of chest-beating satisfaction at the root of this. How fucking lame and archaic. I mean, shit, seriously? On the heels of that thought is the knowledge that this same kid has turned Brooke Cameron into an ardent defender of motherhood. Her own, of course, not the institution itself. But still, there must be some primitive impulse to blame. 6 hours later, I'm meeting with Dad to decide what to do next. Dropping into a seat across from him, I wait while he finishes a client email. His home office looks the same as it always has, a near duplicate of his high-rise headquarters, but I haven't given it a detailed survey in years. He doesn't meet with clients here, of course, so there's no need for posturing. Tasteful artwork, perfectly aligned legal books, smiling family photos. Accordingly, the only artwork hanging on the walls consists of a couple of repulsively gruesome war paintings he inherited from his parents, who died when I was too young to retain a memory of them. The built-ins behind him house a disordered arrangement of California and federal criminal law volumes, penal code, the titles of which made me snicker as a 10-year-old, and thick tomes housing Supreme Court precedents. I thank fate once again for making me an actor, though at times I wonder how far apart my dad's career and my own actually are. On his credenza is an array of framed photos, all turned to face his desk, as though he glances at them occasionally, or can if he decides to. The largest is my favorite of my parents on their wedding day. Next to it is Mom holding me the day I was born, she fresh-faced and beautiful, and me, nothing but a cranky face the size of a grapefruit, encased in a tube of blue blankets. Another shows Mom and me on my first day of kindergarten, my backpack more like a giant shell on my back. She smiles down at me, her hand on my head, and I'm all teeth and big blue eyes, laughing straight into the camera. While Dad taps at the keyboard, I rise and pick up the pewter frame. Looking closer, I mentally compare this photo to the one of River. Only a year older than he is now, I look much bigger. My clothes are new and expensive. A mirror image of what hip adolescence wore at the time, though at 5 I couldn't possibly have known or cared. My expression is far from solemn. Even so, I see him in my features. I see him, if he was cared for, and happier. I didn't want this, any of it, but it's like I'm stuck on a track, and the train is coming, and there's nothing I can do but accept the inevitable and try to mitigate the collateral damages. All done, Dad says, and I set the photo back in its place and take a seat in front of his desk, leaning forward, elbows on knees, hands clasped. Mirroring the sensation I got walking between Brooke's box towers a few days ago, the walls are closing in.
I don't expect you to answer what I'm about to say right now, though we haven't got the time to linger over decisions. You've said that Miss Cameron intends to adopt the child.
River.
River, right.
His pen scratches across the pad. Do you know whether she intends to continue to live in L.A.? Or move back to Texas? She's moving into a two-bedroom condo near the one she's in now. I assume that means she plans to be here most of the time, if not all of the time. Pursing his lips, he taps his pen, staring at his handwritten notes.
My initial reaction was hope that I could extricate you from this situation, because this isn't something for which you can serve a few weeks of community service or pay a fine, and then it's all over.
He leans up and our eyes lock, his dark like Dory's, and I wonder how long it's been since he's looked at me so directly.
I'm not going to lecture you about protection. I think you know these things, and you probably knew them then, but not well enough to be consistent. If anyone should be lectured, it's me. Christ, you weren't even 15 when this happened.
He runs a hand through his salt-and-pepper hair, his jaw locked.
The fact remains you fathered a child, even if you were a child yourself at the time. And instead of living with settled adoptive parents, he's presently in foster care. And it's very likely he'll be living with your unstable ex-girlfriend soon, minutes away.
What are you saying, Dad?
I'm saying that if you relinquish your rights to him now, you may live to regret it.
Okay. This day is full of unanticipated responses. I nod once and stare at my hands as he continues.
When you were born, I was petrified that I'd be a horrible father. Your grandfather was a hard man, and he taught me nothing of paternal tenderness. I guess in many ways my fear came true. I made it true. But I never turned my back on you. I don't have to look at you right now and try to explain why I signed away my rights to you. Giving up a baby for adoption is a good thing, almost always in cases like yours and Brooke's. What's happened to River is virtually unheard of. It couldn't have been foreseen, and there's little use asking why or how it happened. All that matters is what we choose to do about it now. What you choose to do about it now. Because I won't make this choice for you. But I'll stand by you, no matter what you decide.
I close my eyes and will the walls to shift farther apart so I can breathe. Assuming I don't sign the relinquishment, what happens?
3 choices. 1, you simply refuse to sign it, making the adoption more difficult for Brooke, but likely resulting in an eventual relinquishment by default. 2, join Brooke's bid to adopt and request joint custody. 3, file for full custody. Considering the fact that you were 15 when he was born, she knew you were the father, and no one saw fit to inform your legal guardians, a case could be made that you never legally relinquished your rights. She signed her rights away with full parental consent. You signed nothing, and neither did we.
Brooke will be furious no matter which of those I choose. I'm going to drive Dory away as soon as I spill this to her. And I could destroy my mother's fragile sobriety. What about Mom? What will this do to her? His mouth forms a grim line, and he's silent for a moment.
I've grappled with that all day. I don't know, Reed. She's been going to meetings every day. She's doing well. Better than I've seen her in a decade.
But you and I know that upheavals like this. I dropped my head in my hands, pulled in a million directions. I know. Ever the attorney, he says, I'll have to consider how to best disclose it to her. That will be mine to handle, however. You have enough on your plate.
Chapter 17. Brooke. My discussion with Janelle goes as predicted. She has a gradually mushrooming shit fit, insisting that I should have told her about River long before now. Why? I ask, sitting on the tan leather sofa across from her desk. Boasting an impressive view of Hollywood, Janelle's new corner office is located several floors up from her original shoebox-sized cube with its parking lot view. So I could be prepared for things like this, she exclaims. I roll my eyes. And how exactly would you have prepared for this? I gave him up for adoption when I was 16 and never expected to see him again. If I couldn't have prepared for this, how the hell would you? Fine, she spits her go-to I've had it up to here word at me. But I still think you should have told me. I offer an indolent one-shoulder shrug, which she hates. Janelle, if you don't know by now that there's a load of crap you don't know about me and never will, then we've got an even bigger problem. If the pen she's holding was any thinner, she'd be holding two busted pen halves and a face full of ink. Her jaw clenches and she smiles tightly. Is there anything else you do plan to tell me? Here we go. The reason for my in-person visit. Well, yes. Her eyes widen. You look sheepish. I've never seen you look like this. I don't like it. What? I watch as her quick brain connects the dots and her face pales. Oh, no. Paper oceans. You're still going to do it, right? Brooke. Brooke. I'm too young and healthy to die of a heart attack, even if I want to. I'm sorry, Janelle. I just don't see how I can. Her blanched face refills with pink from the bottom up, like someone is topping it off. But you said, get me an audition for something powerful. You said something like monster, but where I don't have to look ugly like Charlize. And I did it. I did it, Brooke. You were so upset when that Castleberry twit got the role, when she busted her ass, literally, on that slope. It was like a miracle. You don't turn down miracles in this business, Brooke. I can't leave him. I can't leave the process. I hold up a hand to forestall the comment forming on her tongue. I'm not going to screw this up, Janelle. Like a boulder tumbling down a hill, nothing stops her. But screwing up your career is no big deal! Her eyes bug, and I hope she meant what she said about being too healthy to have a heart attack. Can't we just... We'll get you an au pair. We'll send them with you. Angelina hauls her brood all over the globe. Instantly skeptical. Sure, I'd read something about at-home and filming swap-offs. I ask, she does? Hell, I don't know. Probably. Who cares? Because you can. No, I can't. I'll have just gotten placement of him. I can't run off to Australia with him before the adoption is final. She's so googly-eyed that it makes my eyes water to look at her. Look, Brooke, we haven't heard from the studio yet. Maybe something in your circumstances will change, and we won't have to turn it down. Like, maybe the court will tell me I'd be the most screwed-up mother he could have and toss me out on my ass? I don't mean that. I narrow my gaze on her. Have they called you yet? Because if you do anything even remotely resembling an attempt to keep him from me, just so I will do paper oceans, I will fire you so fast you'll be embers. She blinks multiple times and then darts her eyes away, tugging at her suit jacket and harumphing. I'm supposed to call someone back tomorrow, actually, and, of course, I wouldn't do that to you. Seeing Janelle in person was definitely the right move. I know you wouldn't, Janelle. I smile sweetly, my tone conciliatory with a touch of my native drawl. I didn't mean to accuse you. I know you would never do anything to hurt me. The flight to Austin is blissfully uneventful. No broody teenagers or flirtatious businessmen. No Hollywood golden boys I'd like to strangle with my bare hands. When the flight attendant closes the loading door and the seat next to me remains vacant, I mutter, "Oh, thank God!" A bit too vehemently, earning me an arched brow from a lady across the aisle. I pretend not to notice. Feeling the effects of the past week in all its stressful glory, I know one more annoyance might result in an air marshal and handcuffs. Finally free of the breakneck round of promotion for Hearts, I'm heading back to Texas to address the final pieces of my application for River's adoption, one of which is my mother, who will soon be contacted for her opinion on my suitability as an adoptive parent, as if she would have a clue. Sometime in my pre-adolescence, some jackass came up with the term MILF, and the boys I knew quickly applied it to my mother. Now, Mom's a 3-times divorced cougar, and instead of being mortified at those titles, she wears them like she wore the Hayseed Beauty Queen crowns now stored in a lighted display case. Proudly. She refuses to see that her looks are all she's ever had going for her, and now that she's on the verge of losing them, she's become a pathetic stereotype. Never undertaking any sort of career aside from securing and discarding husbands, she's accepted a multitude of labels over the years, including trophy wife and single mother. When I was little, she called herself a stay-at-home mom whenever it suited her, though she did little to nothing to earn that designation. I know how she'll respond to my bid to adopt River. I knew before I came. Because out of all the titles she's willingly assumed, I can't imagine Grandma ever being one of them. I haven't seen my mother since she showed up in L.A. last spring, without notice, expecting entrance to the premiere and after-party of School Pride, for herself and her latest cougar bait. I granted them entrance to the film, but pretended I couldn't get her into the party on such short notice. Total bullshit. But there was no way I was dealing with her up close and personal, while Reed and I focused on our doomed plan to break up Graham and Emma. When I arrive at her downtown apartment at our prearranged time, 10 a.m. She's fully made up, but still wearing her black dressing gown. "Hello, Brooke." She smiles tightly. I'm pretty sure she's had work done since I've seen her, because her facial features look a tad stretched. Her caramel eyes are the same as always, somehow cold, despite their warm color. Leading me into the familiar living area, she gestures toward the plush sectional, and I sit while she grabs her cup of coffee from the kitchen counter and sits without offering me anything. A new yappy dog runs up and barks annoyingly, beginning to nip at my ankles until I lean down and growl, a trick I learned with the last one. Like its predecessor, it runs away bleating. "I assume there's a reason for your visit beyond terrorizing Tipsy." "Tipsy?" Where Catherine's drawl is comforting, my mother's inflections wring my insides like dish rags. I hate the sound of her voice. I hate her calculating eyes. I hate that I came from her. That she tried to make me into her likeness and in many ways succeeded. I hate that I can't escape this connection, no matter what I do. I fix her with a polished stare of my own. "Yes. I'm here to inform you of a decision I've made that will affect you, though probably not much." Her mask drops for a moment and curiosity peeks through. "Oh?" I take a breath through my nose and just blurt it out. "I've applied for custody of my son." "I'm sorry, what?" Her penciled-on eyebrows would no doubt arch if they could. "He was taken from his adoptive mother because of extreme neglect, and he's currently a ward of the state. I've applied to adopt him." I wait while she processes what I've just told her, wondering if I'll have to repeat it with smaller words. "What the hell are you saying, Brooke? Did CPS come after you to take—" "No, this was my choice." She blinks, her mouth going slack. "You mean to tell me you are on purpose taking back that brat you gave away 5 years ago?" "Oh, hell no." I breathe through my nose one more time. "Do not ever call him that again." "Don't call him a brat. People will call him worse. After all, he is a bastard. The slap shocks us both. I stand, shaking. My hand stings, and the pink print of it is visible on her cheek until she covers it with her palm. Her eyes are radiating indignation, gears spinning behind them, and every defensive instinct I have is on red alert. A caseworker is going to call you. Tell them whatever you'd like about me. I'm sure you will anyway. Just make sure whatever you tell them is the truth. If you lie, and I find out about it, I will go straight to a reporter I know at People, and she'll happily whip up a sweet little story about my relationship with you that will make Joan Crawford look like Mother Mary. The false threat rolls off my tongue, but I calculate that I can make it true if I have to. I've turned into the famous little actress daughter you wanted. Now you can return the favor by staying the hell out of my life. Feel free to claim me in your laughable circle of expendable acquaintances, but fuck with me or my son, and I will make you wish I was never born. Oh, don't worry. I'm way ahead of you there. Her snarling face resembles that of her overbred, ankle-snapping dog. You always were a selfish little bitch. Her words render me breathless for a moment, and bring back all of those backhanded slaps from my childhood and adolescence, the hair-pulling, the cruel verbal jabs about any imperfection. Well, I learned from an expert. I smile, as if nothing she's ever said has affected me, which feels like the biggest lie I've ever told. Have a nice life, Sharla. Marching to the door without a backward glance, I bite my tongue until I taste blood. I will not cry in front of her. That's what therapists are for, goddammit, and I'm getting one as soon as I get back to L.A. I slam her door behind me and dial my father's number once I get to the pickup truck I borrowed from Glenn. I might as well get all the hell over with in one day. Daddy, I say when he answers, I have something to tell you. Do you have a minute?
Reed. In view of what I'm about to tell Dory and what I'm about to ask of her, I feel like a two-faced asshole when I pick her up the Friday evening before her birthday. All she knows is that I'm taking her across the bay into San Fran for the weekend. I promised her she'd have time to study for a major exam scheduled for Monday, which would be humorous if I wasn't so preoccupied with the coming conversation. I've decided not to tell her until Sunday. I'm going to give her the best weekend of her life before I disclose this sort of news. If there was any way around it, I would put it off longer. I hate that I have to tell her at all, ever. On a bookcase shelf in her library alcove, my mother has a small, wooden-carved quotation by Robert Frost that says, "The best way out is always through." I've never fully understood that line until now. The solitary drive on the 5 from L.A. to Berkeley is even more monotonous than I remember from the road trip John and I took a couple of years ago. I want my own wheels this weekend, though, so we won't have to rely on chauffeured transportation. When I pull onto the side street next to her dorm, almost everyone ogles the car. It's not my Yellow Lotus. I think Dory would have appreciated Dad's mocking douche taxi title, had she been around at the time. But the feline body shape and headlights and the Ferrari mark are conspicuous, even in a staid gray. At the corner just ahead, Dory spots me, ducks her chin, and hurries to the passenger side. Her hair is swept into a giant clip at the back of her head, and she's wearing jeans, dark green chucks, and a cowl sweatshirt. She's using her backpack as an overnight bag, which makes me wonder if she has any decent luggage. Something else I need to remedy soon. My heart rate jams into high gear as she slips inside and shuts the door. "Happy birthday," I say, taking her face in my hands and kissing her. She braces one hand against my chest, twisting it into my shirt and leaning closer as her mouth opens under mine. It's been 26 days since I've seen her, and that interval somehow feels like hours one moment and years the next. There's a sense of desperation to this kiss that scares me. Because it's not just coming from me.
"Thank you again for last weekend."
"It was nothing. I wish I could have been with you."
"I'm so sorry."
Something flares in her eyes and she lowers them quickly, like a window shade screening whatever she's thinking. I pull her chin up. What? She shakes her head and tries to smile, but she's no actress.
It's nothing. I'm just... still sad. I don't want to ruin the weekend you've planned. Let's not talk about it. I'll be okay.
I want to press her to tell me what's going through her mind. I want to tease her about what a horrible liar she is, and how I need to give her lessons if she means to do it right. But the words stick in my throat. I can't call her on a fib with what I've been hiding from her.
No problem, I whisper, kissing her again before taking her backpack and placing it in the seat behind her.
I plan to indulge your every desire this weekend, Miss Cantrell. She's unusually quiet as I maneuver through in-town traffic. Crossing the bay, she stares out her window, silently watching the yachts and fishing boats, her gaze rising to follow the occasional seagull. For the 100th time, I struggle to find some way out of telling her about River. Not now, not this weekend. But I may not see her until her spring recess, a month away. Sometime in the next few days, Dad will start the adoption process. After I've told Brooke, of course. They've accelerated the schedule for my next film, much of which will be shot on set at Universal Studios in L.A., with the rest shot in Utah and New York. Filming was supposed to start in April. Instead, we're starting next week, with the scenes in Utah up first. The best way out is always through. I've made Saturday dinner reservations, so when I suggest that we stay in and order room service tonight, Dory agrees. You can even do a little studying, I say, and she crooks an eyebrow at me, dubious. Maybe like 20 minutes worth. Pulling up to the valet at the Mandarin, I add, once dinner arrives, though, you're mine. Grinning, I grab our bags and hop out. We're definitely recognized at the front desk. Or at least I am. I think the desk clerk is more than a little worried that I'm checking in with an underage girl, given Dory's backpack and makeup-free face. Thank God for the cowl-wear she's sporting, which suggests that she's the co-ed she is. Within minutes, we're in the designated elevator, zooming up to the suite.
Oh, my gosh, my stomach, she says, holding on to me and laughing.
No need for the elevator to waste time when it doesn't plan to stop anywhere along the way. I promise that's the last rushed experience you'll have tonight. I kiss her nose as the doors slide open.
Everything else will be unhurried and deliberate.
If you want something faster, I bend to whisper in her ear and she gives a gratifying shiver.
You'll have to say so.
Her lips part when she sees the suite, and she's speechless for several minutes, standing in the doorway and scanning from one side to the other and back. Finally, she leaves the entrance, tentatively, and moves into the room.
This is all... ours? This is one room?
I shrug, enjoying her amazement. It's a suite. Within minutes, we're enjoying an unobstructed view of a breathtaking sunset over the bay, judging by the fact that she seems to stop breathing, watching it. I couldn't have timed this better if I'd actually scheduled our arrival time to coincide with the sun's measured retreat. True to my word, I set her up at the desk and let her do her thing while I put our stuff away and order a dinner of champagne, nasi goreng, and Singapore noodles, to be delivered in an hour and a half. Time's up. I lean over her and nuzzle her cheek. I've given you a very generous half hour of study time. She leans her head back on my shoulder and closes her eyes.
I can't only study for half an hour. I'm going to fail.
I pull her chair away from the desk and kiss her behind the ear, eliciting a soft moan. If you're a good girl, I'll allow you another half hour tomorrow.
I'm always a good girl, Reed, she says,
and the ear I'm attending to warms under my tongue.
I mean,
no explanation needed. I chuckle, kissing down her neck before releasing her hair from the clip and slipping her sweatshirt off. Underneath, she's wearing a white tank with a scooped neckline trimmed in lace, which I can see straight down from my vantage point behind her. A sweatshirt. With this hidden beneath it?
Jesus, Dory.
My head is swimming with wanting her, and I'm determined to pay her back in kind, and then some. Cupping my hands over her shoulders and sliding forward, my thumbs follow the line of her collarbone while my fingers brush over the curves of her breasts.
You're perfect.
She starts to object, and I place two fingers over her mouth, slipping my other hand into the top of her white lace bra. She arches back and gasps, giving me better access to her warm skin, her heart beating against the palm of my hand. Pulling her up and kicking the chair out of the way, I turn her and am kissing her deeply before she can take a breath. Her tank follows the sweatshirt to the floor. Gripping her hips, I ask, "Shower before, during, or after? Since you're the birthday girl, your wish is my command."
"During?" Her brow creases. "During what? Oh.
I release her long enough to pull my t-shirt off, and then lift her until she settles her legs around me and hooks her ankles at the base of my spine. Carrying her into the bathroom, I say, "What you're doing right now?" "Yes." I kiss her. "Exactly this. In about 3 minutes." She slides down the length of me when I put her down to switch on the hot water and then turn to remove her jeans. I'm kneeling, tugging her jeans from her feet when she says,
"I thought you said something about unhurried."
She steps out of them, nibbling her lower lip and standing in front of me in nothing but scraps of white lace.
"So I did," I answer.